Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Here go.
Let it bump, though. Hello, everyone, and welcome to what is a highly anticipated edition of the Hardwood Knox podcast this time, because Andy and I are lucky enough to be joined by Duncan Smith of Pistons Powered, and he is also the host of the Locked On Pistons podcast, which you should absolutely check out when you get a chance. This is going to be the first of our season preview package that we're rolling out. We are not going in any sort of order. We're just tackling the teams as they kind of come to us and interest us. And we're excited to get started with Duncan here. So to start things off, how are you doing today, Duncan?
I'm doing great. And I'm especially excited to lead this off because the Pistons don't come first in much. So we can chalk this one in the leadoff column at least.
They should hang a banner for that.
Hey.
Well, you know,
Detroit Lions might do something like that.
Okay.
Andy and I have been talking on, I don't even think it was a Pistons related podcast, and the Pistons just came up about how fascinating they are. And I think that's why for me this was just a good place to start, because I feel like they're so, there's just such a divergent line drawn through where you stand on their, where people stand on their off season, where they stand on their outlook. Did they have a good off season? Was it actually terrible? So, you know, whenever it creates that type of divide, that really fascinates me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that like fans and people who are like more connected to the team have a higher view of the offseason, which in itself is kind of remarkable, because Pistons fans in general are a highly pessimistic and occasionally self-loathing group. You know, the only time the Pistons have ever moved up in the lottery, they got Darko. You know, it's not a fan base that really gets a lot of things handed to them. So I think that you know, they kind of expect the worst, which is, you know, a fair thing to expect, especially like over some of the dark and grim years that the Pistons have had the last almost decade, really. But yeah, you know, nationally, I think that most people really kind of hate the Pistons offseason, whereas like more on a local basis, you know, I think that there's something of an appreciation, or at least a willingness to let it play out and see what happens before we bring it all down, which is kind of where I'm at myself.
Well, I think we need to start, and I don't know if it's like a twofold or a threefold situation, but the Pistons use a bulk of the non-taxpayers' mid-level exception on Langston Galloway on the first day of free agency. They turn Marcus Morris into Avery Bradley. They let Kentavious Caldwell-Pope walk just for nothing. I'm trying, from my standpoint, and you know where I stand on this because we've had back and forths, and I've written about how high I am on Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I was, more than anything, even more so than I disliked the move, and I did dislike that series of moves. I was just shocked because I spent, it was a day, it was a half of a day around the Pistons when they were in Brooklyn toward the end of the season, and the way Stan Van Gundy was talking was that they knew what offers were coming, and it just seemed like they were going to keep KCP. And my assumption was, even when the market kind of became this restrictive place where players weren't getting the offers we thought that they were going to get, it was always just in my head that, well, the Pistons are just going to re-sign KCP, or the Pistons are going to match whatever offer he might sign. So I was genuinely surprised to see them go in that direction, especially given the returns that they got. Langston Galloway, to me, nice player. I liked watching him a lot when he was in New York. He tries really hard, but is he the guy that you hard cap yourself for on the first day of free agency?
Yeah, I agree with your assessment that, like, right up until the Pistons didn't pay the price to keep KCP, I was under the impression the entire time that was what was going to happen. Like, I think by the middle of November, I had begun writing like extensive pieces for Piston Powered on like the how and why the Pistons must and will re-sign KCP, you know, regardless of the price, all the way up to and including the max and whatever else the Brooklyn Nets, which was at the time, you know, the expectation that was where the truckload of money was coming from. So yeah, I was convinced right up until it didn't happen that that he was sticking around. I did think, however, that a couple of moves that Brooklyn made in particular really they really hampered KCP's expectation from the Nets. The trade before the draft between the Lakers and the Nets, where the Nets came away with D'Angelo Russell, almost right away I had a couple pieces up about how like that trade itself might have cost KCP a lot of money. And honestly, you know, I think that that was part of a spiral of events that kind of led us to where we're at right now. But yeah, I agree on the Galloway thing. It's he does fit, you know, multiple roles that the Pistons need. They are not a team that really can afford to like just throw some 20-year-old minimum guy or some like 35-year-old minimum guy out there at third point guard, because if Reggie Jackson can't go, your third point guard now becomes a backup point guard with your starter being Ish Smith. So, you know, that role ends up being important. So I think the Pistons may have, you know, as is sort of their habit these last few off seasons, they definitely overpaid for Galloway. I think there's no doubt about that. But making him the guy that you hard cap yourself for is also a bit puzzling. I have this feeling, this is not based on anything, and I think Rod Beard, who's a beat writer for the Detroit News, disagrees with this. But I have this feeling that the Pistons were not especially concerned with the hard cap because they had a spending limit handed down from like ownership. I don't have anything to base this on other than the fact that they clearly didn't really care that much about hard capping themselves if they went out and did that literally by what, 1 o'clock, I think, on July 1st.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Basically, like either they were not fully aware of the mechanics of how that hard cap situation works, which I don't think, and I certainly would hope is not the case. Or they were simply not concerned about hard capping themselves, because I'm pretty sure they could have gotten him for what, $1.5 million less, and gotten under that taxpayer's exception. So I feel as though like they're acting on an edict from like a total spending perspective. But again, why Lynx and Galloway is that guy, I don't really know.
Okay, here's my question. Let's say you're sort of an ambassador for the front office. How do you sell me or sell fans on the Avery Bradley acquisition? I know it's not really a direct swap, but if you look at it from sort of an outsider's perspective, it does look like it's basically KCP for Avery Bradley. And I was actually just looking at those two players head-to-head last night, and KCP is 3 inches taller. He's almost 3 years younger. I think there's significantly more upside there. So if you are a Detroit Pistons team employee, or if you're just Duncan Smith, how do you sell Avery Bradley? How do you make this look like put a positive spin on it, basically?
Well, I think that if they can retain Avery Bradley, if they can get him to stay for, you know, the max, which is most likely the end result, or less, which would be favorable, but I'd say highly unlikely. If they can get him to stick around, I'd say this is a deal that was a win. Part of my pay KCP movement throughout the season was largely predicated on you know, getting him under contract so we could see what he can be down the road. You know, he's got the upside, he's got potential, all of this, but you know, I think Avery Bradley is kind of like his best case scenario. Like, I think his ceiling is probably like an Avery Bradley, or like a poor man's Avery Bradley, to be honest. You know, like this was largely his breakout season, and while he had like he had a shoulder injury that took place in the middle of January in a game against Golden State, he came back, like, I think 7 games later, and he said he was fine. The Pistons said he was fine. Stan said he was fine. But he, from that point on, from basically the halfway point of the season on, him and Reggie Jackson were in a competition for, like, worst Piston. And so it really throws off his numbers from last season. But, like, even at his peak, you know, he was shooting 40% from three. He was shooting 40% from the floor. And his defensive numbers had fallen off considerably, and perhaps not so much that that you would really be happy about that trade-off to basically, like, a somewhat slightly above league average true shooting percentage, I think, at that point. You know, by the end of the year, like, all of his shooting numbers except for his three-point percentage had basically cratered. His defensive numbers had cratered. Some of the guys from Lakers film room had did some pretty extensive synergy breakdowns and video breakdowns on KCP's time, especially, like, post injury, and he was, like, in the 10th percentile in a lot of different things, like, post injury. So he went from being basically a guy who was, like, league average maybe plus defender to among, like, the best among the worst regular defenders in the NBA post injury. So it really makes it, like, hard to really assess, you know, what his breakout season really was. But from, like, a defensive standpoint, I think that his reputation is kind of buoyed by the fact that he was widely considered to be, like, the best perimeter defender on this Pistons roster. You know, with good reason, I think he certainly was. But I think that maybe Pistons fans and some, like, general NBA observers, I think they kind of overrate his defense, you know, kind of on the whole. Like, he hustles, no doubt, but, like, from a defensive standpoint, Bradley is without a doubt his ceiling, I think, and Bradley does more with less. You know, like you mentioned, KCP is about 3 inches taller. I think Bradley is closer to 2. I think he's, like, just a little over 2 years. I'll have to double check that, but I think he's a little bit, the age gap is a little bit closer than you were thinking.
Okay.
I think it's closer to, like, just over 2 years rather than just under 3. So, I mean, we're quibbling here, but
that can make a difference, though.
Yeah. Like, KCP, I think, is a little older than people think, and he's not so much younger than Avery Bradley that 2 years is necessarily going to be, like, a huge gap. You know, I mean, Bradley's 26, KCP is 24. Like, they're both kind of entering, you know, their prime in a way. You know, Bradley, I think, has kind of entered it already and is probably, his ceiling is probably not so much higher than KCP's might be right now. But, you know, KCP is never going to be a scorer on the level of Avery Bradley either. And, you know, I think basically to wrap it all back around to my original point, you know, Marcus Morris and KCP, I think, is an acceptable price to pay. If it's a big if they can get him to stay next year. And I think that that's going to require winning. And I think that that's going to require, you know, probably not a first round exit either. Bradley's a guy who's accustomed to getting the playoffs, and he was a Eastern Conference finalist last year. And I don't think that we can underestimate the impact that his playoff experience can have as far as his expectations go this season.
I think.
Well, one thing I think is kind of working in Detroit's favor on that end is, we saw the cap squeeze a lot of teams this summer, and I think it could be even tighter next year. So I would wonder where else Avery Bradley would even get that max if he's not going to get it from Detroit.
That's a really good point. Like, it's not just, you know, restricted free agents who are raked through the coals this year and are probably going to be raked even harder next year. You know, it's going to be like these big money non-LeBron James guys who are maybe going to have to stick around with their incumbents a little more necessarily than, you know, this season and certainly last season. I think that incumbent teams are going to have a huge advantage because there just isn't going to be that much max space. And those teams that have been working to get max space, you know, they might be looking at LeBron James more than Avery Bradley.
Yeah, it's going to be it was hitting the lottery to be a free agent in 2016 and every year since. Yep. Not even close. What were you going to say, Dan? Sorry, I cut you off.
Oh, no, that's fine. The thing I just can't wrap my head around is this isn't necessarily a KCP for Avery Bradley swap, because you lost Marcus Morris too, who is a pretty versatile defender, and he was on a great contract. And if you were really high on Avery Bradley, and I guess this kind of comes back to the Galloway contract, is there would have been a path to re-signing KCP and then still trading for Avery Bradley for what they ultimately ended up giving up, even if it entailed a jettisoning salary to a third team to make that money work once you are coming up on that tax line. So I get where Avery Bradley could probably and should be considered an immediate upgrade in a lot of areas. I don't necessarily know that he's ever had to, or at least not recently, he hasn't had to shoulder the offensive responsibilities that KCP did last year, where he almost became, for a good part of the season, it seemed like their second most featured pick-and-roll guy. And that wasn't really the case, I guess, by the end of the year after his injury, when you did have Reggie Jackson back for a bit. But Avery Bradley didn't seem like he had to do as much as that. He was scoring off of a lot of cuts and a lot of spot-ups, and he was on a team with the Celtics that created a ton of spacing. I don't necessarily know that Detroit is going to be able to replicate that spacing. And I get the interest in him just on the fundamental level. I just, it's uncomfortable to me to kind of give up for nothing, let alone on this 24-year-old in KCP who fits the mold of what you want to do in the NBA right now as kind of a multi-position wing. And to do it for Galloway, who's in essence an undersized two guard, because, you know, we're talking about using him as their third string point guard, I guess. And yes, he can run some point, but he's better suited at the two. And even if he is your third string point guard, you don't give your third string point guard most of the mid-level exception. It just doesn't happen, especially with the way the free agent market ended up unfolding this summer. And so that's probably the toughest thing I have to get around, is that there was so much more involved here than just, well, Avery Bradley's the better fit than Caldwell Pope to me. And maybe it does all work out. Maybe Bradley's fantastic for the Pistons, and I do think it helps, as Andy pointed out, that the market for free agents isn't expected to be too aggressive next year. But what if you were the team that ended up with the one-year flyer on KCP? And yes, you could lose him next summer, or maybe he ends up being cheaper in the long run because he decided to wait until 2018 to try and get his money. I just, hard capping yourself that soon, and then also getting Avery Bradley on an expiring deal while you're giving up Marcus Morris, while you're also paying Langston Galloway, it all just sits not well with me. And it's made even worse by the fact that I don't know that the Pistons, at least when we look at the rumor mill, I don't know that they understand what they want to do, just because we see Reggie Jackson and Andre Drummond in trade rumors, not necessarily of late, although there was that rumor from Michael Scotto of Basketball Insiders with Reggie Jackson at the beginning of the summer involved with the Pelicans. But to have those guys involved in hypothetical deals and trade rumors leading into the deadline, you know, they're supposed to be your two cornerstones. They're your two highest paid players now, or Reggie Jackson, I think, makes the same as Tobias Harris, at least for next season. So looking at all of this, like kind of stepping back, it's just so hard to wrap my head around and to feel good about, because a lot of this seems like we can throw a lack of foresight out the window, or we can throw the whole bad decision-making slant out the window. I'm just not entirely sure the Pistons understand what they're trying to be right now.
I think that really kind of what the attempt is to see like what this core can actually do. You know, I mean, KCP is no longer part of the core. Avery Bradley will be part of the core. Stanley Johnson will hopefully be more part of the core this season. I think that the goal really is to sort of kick the can down the road like one more year. You know, Reggie Jackson coming out and basically going from the Pistons' best player in 2015-16 to essentially probably like a top five bottom five rotational player as far as damaging impact on the floor last year on both ends. You know, I think that impact can't be underestimated. You know, if you take the best player on almost any team and then you go into 2K editor and you take away like all the stuff that he's good at, and you then transform him into like a damaging impact player on the floor, you know, it's really going to have a detrimental effect to basically everything you're trying to do as a team. And I think that that's a big reason that the Pistons fell off last year. You know, Jackson had no burst, no explosiveness. He couldn't do anything defensively. You know, there's a lot of optimism and a hope that like his rehabilitation this summer is going to have him in a better place going forward. But I mean, knee tendonitis is chronic, so it's never going to be a matter of like, now it's gone, now he's better. It's always going to be sort of a management and strengthening situation. So we really aren't going to know until he gets onto the floor in, you know, basically in training camp, where he might not even be doing like 2-a-days during camp. And that's also kind of concerning because he doesn't have the best conditioning at his best. You know, this is, I think that Stan wants to get one more year and figure out what this core really can do before taking steps to blow the thing sky high. And I do think that, you know, if Reggie can't get things going, this team is probably a bit more able to deal with the malfunctioning starting point guard this year than they were last year. You know, you mentioned Langston Galloway being the third point guard. I think that the majority of his minutes will come as backup too, behind Bradley. But you know, if Reggie Jackson can't go, or if he's severely diminished, like he was last season, and that's going to throw those plans in disarray. And now instead of Galloway being the backup two, we're going to have Luke Kennard elevated probably ahead of schedule. And it really kind of throws everything into disarray. So I think a big reason behind their willingness to move on from having to give KCP his payday, presumably, I mean, if he stuck around and was a restricted free agent, maybe he's in a situation that that Nerlens Noel is in. Probably not so much, because I think that the KCP is still in high demand, even if a restricted free agent. But you know, rather than give him his big payday now, coming off a 37-win season, you know, maybe you want to put yourself in a situation where you get to take one more look at this team. You get to see if Andre Drummond, you know, if the nasal surgery that he had this summer, Shamik Mohiel actually from Piston Powered wrote a really insightful piece on the kind of impact that deviated septum can have on a player, particularly on back-to-backs, the second game of back-to-backs, which Andre was exceptionally bad at this season. You know, if Reggie's knee can come into play, and if it turns out that oxygen is an important thing to Andre Drummond, you know, it might be a better time next year to be able to take a look and see if this is a team where you want to make that final move to go all in salary-wise and max Avery Bradley rather than max KCP, who shot 39.2% from the field this year and was one of the worst defenders in the league post-injury. You know, is the shoulder better? I don't know if we know that. You know, he didn't improve as the season went on. You know, if there is more structural in there that we aren't aware of, I think, you know, I mean, that last part is kind of a stretch, but I think it's something that that they are looking at. Whereas, like, I think nationally there's, like you said, a take that the Pistons aren't really sure what they want to do. I think here what we have is more of just like kind of a holding pattern to see, get one more year of evaluation and I suspect that if they're like 5 games below 500 come the new year, they're just going to blow the whole thing up and make that it, basically. I don't think that there's going to be a long leash for this team, especially, you know, for Reggie and Andre. If they're not going to work, they're not going to work, and that'll be it.
That was kind of my next question, actually, was it was sort of the opposite of the way you ended that answer, is what level of success do the Pistons need to have for the front office to be like, okay, we're in on this group. We're going to we're going to commit to Jackson, Drummond, Stanley Johnson, Tobias Harris, and kind of march forward with this group that we have?
You know, I think it's definitely playoffs or bust in this highly diminished Eastern Conference. You know, if they make the playoffs, I don't see like significant changes coming. But you know, if even if they limp into it, I think that you know, there will be a good long look taken by the front office at a number of the pieces on this team. But it's so hard to really forecast what we're going to get. You know, like so much stems from Reggie Jackson and that pick and roll, which was actually not all that bad last year as far as Jackson and Drummond go. But if you take a look at like the passes out of the pick and roll, the Pistons were absolutely dreadful in like hitting unguarded or guarded shots out of the pick and roll beyond just Jackson or Drummond finishing. So I think that so much is going to stem from that, and I think that spacing is probably a big reason for that too. You know, it was easy to sort of cheat a bit and force Reggie to drive, and his burst is problematic. You know, Andre's efficiency was actually not as bad, I think, in a lot of respects as people think. You know, like obviously, like we all know about his post up situation.
Is there any chance Stan Van Gundy will just give up on that and just try and turn him into a rim roller like a DeAndre Jordan, Rudy Gobert type? Or is he just fully committed to trying to turn him into a post player?
It's been my dream for like at least a season and a half, probably, that he more models himself after DeAndre Jordan. You know, like I don't think that the post up is necessarily a lost cause if he stops taking his post opportunities from 9 feet out. Like if he gets inside that 5 foot mark, he's more or less unstoppable, and he's one of the best in there. But you know, he only took like 49% of his shots from inside 3 feet last year, I think. And
wow.
Yeah. Like if you look at DeAndre Jordan, I did a sort of a side-by-side comparison because of some of the somewhat ridiculous, I think, trade rumors surrounding the two of them. I think DeAndre took like 70% of his shots from inside 3 feet. Like that's what you want Andre Drummond doing. You don't want him like finessing from 10 feet out. Like, I don't care what he's done this summer in the Drew League and at, the Africa game. He shouldn't be taking shots from outside of like 5 feet from the basket. And they should be like of the aggressive rim rattling variety and not these like fadeaway posts and like long distance hooks and stuff like that. You know, I think that shot selection with him is a big issue. And I don't know if that's more simply a matter of the fact that he demands the ball where he demands the ball, or if it's somewhat schematic on the part of like Stan Van Gundy and the Pistons. I know he would love to run the four out one in system, but I'm not convinced that Andre Drummond is necessarily the guy that the Pistons necessarily have that kind of personnel to be able to pull that off. And I also am not entirely sure that that's really, you know, without like a transcendent big man, I don't really know if that's necessarily the style you want to run in 2017.
I know a lot of people talk about positioning for Drummond when they're feeding him in the post. And I totally get that because early on in Dwight Howard's career, he's able to kind of just catch the ball deep. And I don't think you can necessarily say, I mean, his footwork at one point was really, really good, but I don't necessarily think you can say he was like this coordinated mogul, but he was just so overpowering and overbearing once he got deep that he was able to finish at a high level. And there's certainly an element of that to Drummond. These what amount to feel like mid-range hook shots are just terrible. And I also don't, is he the passer that can kind of function as the fulcrum of this post-up offense? And that seems to be like another element to me. I think every year we're talking about, oh, he's making a little bit better decisions out of the double team, or it seems like he's more aware when he has the ball in his hands. But I feel like we just haven't seen enough improvement necessarily on either front. And when you're talking about giving a guy, let's say, one quarter of his shots in post-ups, not only do you want him to establish proper positioning, but you need to count on him to make kind of the necessary pass. And I still don't think Andre Drummond, after all this time, is that guy, which is why, as both you and Andy pointed out, and I think you pointed out to me previously, it would be really beneficial, if not necessary, to the Pistons' offense that he does kind of become that DeAndre Jordan type player, even in volume, even if it comes at slashing his post touches. I get that logistically maybe it could work, but how long do we have to say logistically maybe it could work to see that when it's not working, okay, finally we just need to completely move away from it? I'm not even talking about just diminishing the number, but it just looks like at this moment they really need to slash it and get away from it altogether.
Yeah, you mentioned the passing, and 2 years ago he was a somewhat infrequent but fairly effective passer out of the post. He passed out of the post 46 times, and the Pistons scored 56 points. You know, that's not much, but you know, at least it's like it's a positive expectation when he does actually pass out of the post. This season was a bit of a different story. He passed out of the post 18 times. The Pistons scored 9 points on those 18 passes, and he had a turnover percentage something like 45%. It's crazy because like he demonstrates some incredibly sharp court vision at times. Like some of these passes, he will like not necessarily out of the post, obviously, because it's only happened 18 times in the past. calendar year wise, a long time. Like he does, it seems like he sees things sometimes, but it's another thing that's really frustrating when it comes to Drummond, because like the ball dumps down into the post and everybody stops because they know it's not coming back out unless they're running back and on defense because he turned it over or something. It's really frustrating because like the 27.5% of post-ups, or 27.5% of his touches are post-ups, exact same percentage as in 15-16. Everybody knows it's going to happen. He's gonna take that shot, or he's gonna turn that over. Almost exclusively, and the Pistons, pardon me, the Pistons, the movement just really stagnates, and it makes it really hard to do anything effective out of the post. And he's not good enough to be this like true focal point post scorer, obviously. I think he's in the 19th percentile by the end of the season.
Man, if he could just if he was just one of those mid to high 60s field goal percentage pure rim running centers, I still think he could average like 15 and 15, and I think it would do wonders for the Pistons. You don't. That's the thing about today's game, and I'm not sure how many big men understand this. You don't have to be like an old school post up Patrick Ewing type to get your points. And I mean, he's physically suited as well as anybody to be that sort of new school center. So I hope he can figure that out.
I will say to interrupt that it's kind of a bit of a red flag that his assist percentage out of the post was lower than Hassan Whiteside's, and we'll just leave it at that.
Well, that's another reason. That's another reason for him to just be the hardcore rim roller.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I kind of wanted to switch gears.
I did have a question, really quick question for Duncan, for Drummond defensively, and I think we've talked about this too. Can you envision him even playing the DeAndre Jordan type role on defense necessarily? DJ. He's a pretty good switcher for someone his size, and I just don't necessarily – I don't think he's the guy you necessarily want switching all the time, but he survives a lot better in space, at least this season, than I had realized in years past. I don't know that I see that from Drummond just yet, and I do think some of his – even as a more stationary paint protector, rim protector, whatever you want to call it, the results just seem like they haven't necessarily been there either over the past couple years.
I think when he's really engaged, I think he can be that kind of switchy type, the kind of guy who can blow up a possession on the perimeter. But, we see so little of that, high-level engagement. I think that I want to see, like, a full season of of Drummond being able to breathe out of both nostrils, I think, before I really have like a full take on what I think of his energy. Pardon me, I gotta drink something really quick here. Sorry about that.
It happens to me about every episode.
Yeah, it's the first time I think of all the podcasts I've ever been in. It's the first time I could feel my throat closing off.
We pride ourselves on that.
Yeah.
I do think that this breathing thing is a underrated element to what Drummond can bring. You know, whether it is in fact like just inherently he just has a low motor, he's not like a high effort guy, whether that's inherently the case or whether he just doesn't have the energy because, like, you know, he's been breathing half the oxygen a normal human being should be breathing for like his entire basketball career. I don't know, like I keep kind of like coming back to like let's take a look at this next year and see where everything is, but I think this case with Andre Drummond in particular, you know, again, maybe I'm trying to be optimistic because like I do think there's a really good basketball player in there, I think that his engagement can increase if his energy can increase as a result of maximized oxygen intake. So I'm really optimistic that he can be that kind of aggressive, switchy kind of defender along the same mold as DJ.
I think that's totally fair. I would also be very intrigued to see what sort of a difference that surgery might make for him.
Yeah.
If things do go wrong for the Pistons and they do blow it up, they find takers for Jackson and Drummond and maybe a couple other guys, I do still think there are some interesting young pieces kind of waiting in the wings if they choose to rebuild. I like Luke Kennard. I'm still pretty high on Stanley Johnson. I don't know where I stand on Henry Ellenson, but there are some interesting young pieces there. Which guys sort of intrigue you, or are you as sort of high on this young core as I am?
I am cautiously high. I'm very intrigued by Luke Kennard. I'll be honest that leading up into the draft, Donovan Mitchell, I was all in on the Donovan Mitchell train. To the point where I was
take right now.
Yeah, I don't regret at all my thought that Donovan Mitchell is going to be a really good NBA player. So I was pretty fixated on him to the point where I just really wasn't doing that much research on Luke. The draft night came, the Pistons ended up taking Kennard. I was a bit, taken aback because I was unprepared for it to be Luke Kennard. So, I a lot of what I knew of him came from Stan's presser after. He went into detail about a lot of the stuff that Luke can bring to the floor that really kind of breaks the mold of like this, white shooting guard from Duke mold. Where he finds a nice spot in the corner and he'll knock down the three when you get the ball to him. And that's really not Luke Kennard at all. And I find him to be a pretty exciting prospect. Like we'll see how much of it can translate to the NBA level. But I mean, like from a shooting perspective, like that's there. Like he's a deadly shooter. If he doesn't have the athleticism to be like a top tier athlete in the NBA, which he probably doesn't, he has some craft and some creativity that I think is not something you find in a lot of 20-year-olds. I guess he'll probably be 21 by the time the season starts. I'll have to double check that, but he's young. He came out as a sophomore, so maybe 20. but he had a, I think it was a shot against the Miami Heat in summer league that sent it to overtime. And the way he got this shot up, he ended up, shooting with his left hand from his right side of his body. And it was like an 18-footer jump shot, I believe, off the top of my head. He can get off shots in creative ways that I think a lot of, more experienced players even aren't seeking to be able to do. And apparently, he hasn't been like competing against high-level NBA athletes. But apparently his defense is better than expected, and it's another thing that Stan talked about his presser on draft night, is that just because a guy didn't really play defense in college doesn't mean a guy can't play defense. Sometimes it's just effort and engagement, and sometimes a guy from Duke might really not care that much about defending his guy when he's playing North Carolina A&T or something like that. I think a lot of concern about Luke is going to be translatables when it comes to actually playing NBA opponents. But that shooting is going to be a plus for a team that was one of the worst shooting teams in the NBA last year.
And I think going along with what you were saying too, I think the shooting is definitely there, and I agree with you that he's also more than that. I think with his size and some of that craftiness that you talked about, to me, he's closer to a new age guard than a traditional one, who can play sort of both backcourt spots, who can initiate the offense. So I'm pretty high on him too. And sorry, I cut you off. I didn't know if you were going to go into Stanley Johnson there or not, but I wanted to jump in real quick.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I definitely will end up going on to Stanley Johnson. I'm pretty high on him. He definitely had a pretty dreadful regressive season last year. He knows that. We all know that. He and I have talked about a couple times last season being like just an utter disappointment. The way he put it, basically everybody but Tobias was bad last year, and I don't disagree. But he has been, by all accounts, he's been working hard and killing it this year, and I think a lot more of his time has been spent in the lab, essentially, in a development point of view, rather than last year where he was he was pretty much hitting up every game everywhere and just being a man among boys, which is great and everything, but obviously like that isn't a guarantee of translation to an NBA game, because like basically by the first practice of training camp, he'd hurt his foot and he basically derailed on day one, and things never got back on track. So I think this year is a lot more fundamental skill building and building his body as well. From everything I've seen and heard, he's leaner this year. He's more fit. He dropped 86 points in Toronto this weekend at OVO, which, I mean, we can talk about the level of competition, but 86 points in an open gym is impressive for some. So, I think there were like five NBA players in that game. So it's not like he was playing against, like high school kids or anything like that.
I think it was some other NBA player said something on Twitter like 86 is 86, and I agree with that. Like the LaMelo Ball game, the 93 points was a joke kind of because of the way they were playing, but 93 points is 93 points or whatever he scored.
yeah, without a doubt, and I think that was Jordan Clarkson. There were a bunch of guys that were like just like the eyes emoji was like trending,
yeah.
on NBA Twitter because like those guys take that seriously, and those guys know who they're playing against. Like they know that it's not an NBA game, but like, that's a lot of drives to the rim. that's a lot of energy expended, and and still being able to finish through it. I think if anything, it's a testament to his ability to like get out there and keep going, which is probably more a matter of the fact that he's in better shape this year than he was last year. I know that conditioning was a concern that Van Gundy had when it came to Stanley last year at various points. So I think that I think he's had an off season of sharpening himself, and I think that's what he would say as well.
This time next year, whose season will you have been more pleased with, Andre Drummond or Stanley Johnson?
That's a good question. I would say probably Stanley Johnson, because I think Andre Drummond has extremely high expectations, and a lot of them are tied to free throws, and I don't think the free throws are ever going to get fixed. I think he's always going to be like a sub 42% free throw shooter, and that's going to kind of like bring down the whole as far as his like overall perception goes. Whereas If Stanley goes out and he's an above average defender and he's not a complete black hole on offense, I'd say that that's a good step forward for him.
Playoffs, or, well, I guess let's get to the wrap up section where win win projections and playoffs. Where do you see the Pistons sitting at season's end? I think, you know, one of the biggest benefits of their offseason is probably just that the Eastern Conference still sucks and they might have just gotten better by default.
Yeah, honestly, they're one of the few teams that did not just completely shoot themselves in the foot. You know, whatever one says about like the whole KCP for nothing thing, like from a talent perspective at the top, they have, I would say they haven't really taken a step back, and they've improved the shooting problems significantly. Like just about everybody they brought on, I think actually everybody they brought on with the exception of Eric Moreland would have been the best 3-point shooter on this team last year. They've at least addressed some of the concerns, and just holding steady, I think, would have probably made them a playoff team. I think even if Reggie Jackson can't go and he has to play like a diminished role off the bench or not at all, I still think this is probably a playoff team, and it's not because this is now a juggernaut of any sort. I think that basically this team in its current condition last year would have been a playoff team this year. And last year's team wasn't very good. So, I think that we're probably dealing with like a 6 or 7, probably maybe a 7 or 8 seed. I know that Philadelphia being good or bad is going to be pretty telling with, how they fare in like the lower seeds of the Eastern Conference playoff picture. But that's probably where I'm at. I'd say probably like 43, 44 wins.
So you think the 7 or 8 seed in the East is going to have 43 or 44 wins? That's pretty optimistic.
Well, I fear my team's ability to get into the playoffs, and I fear the worst that it's going to take a lot to get there. So, it's incongruous probably with reality, but Pistons fans are pessimistic, and I guess I'm from that vein if I'm saying that 44 wins is going to get to the 7th seed in the East.
Where do you have them, Dan?
It's so tough. I think it's honestly so tough. I think if you look at the playoff picture from last year, the East lost 3 teams. And if we assume that Miami is going to take one of those spots, and then we can assume that the Hornets will take another one, the Pistons have to be, even if you think they're the worst of that 3, and they might not be, you have to put them in the playoffs. I don't know if they'll finish above 500, and finishing above 500, if Duncan's right, if they get to 43, 44, they're probably looking at the
they'll
5
be
seed.
Comfortably, I bet. Yeah.
In the East. Five, yeah. So I would probably put them around, like, I'm going to say 40 or 41, and I think they'll get into the playoffs. If they do get to 43, 44, we're probably going to talk about them as the 5 seed, though, which would be very interesting.
I'm going to go with 39 and still in the playoff conversation. I think after the top 4 or 5 in the East, I think there's going to be a big bunch of like 7 or 8 teams after that top 4 or 5 that are just going to be clawing and scraping with each other all season. And I actually think probably 7 and 8 in the East are going to be under 500.
Could the 6 seed be under 500? Let's be honest, maybe.
I think it's in play. Like, it would be unlikely and maybe a little bit surprising, but that's not impossible to me, as crazy as that sounds.
Well, it'd be the reverse effect of last year, right? Because you look at all the teams that made the playoffs in the 9th seed and up, they were 500 or better. But at the same time, the 6th seed only won 42 games. 5th seed only won 43.
And in the West, it's going to be like, it could be another one of those years where the 8th seed might have 50. So
9th seed might have 55 at this rate. I know that mathematically doesn't work out, but
it's a year where the Pistons should absolutely have a chance to get into the postseason. I would agree with both of you on that. But that, I think, about wraps us up. As we've discussed, pretty much this roster, top to bottom. Duncan,
shout out
your insight.
Tobias Harris.
Yeah. No, good point. I will echo something that Duncan said earlier, that Stanley Johnson said he was the only good player last season, and he really was pretty darn good. So maybe that's why we didn't talk about him, because we just kind of expect him to continue to go onward and upward. Duncan, thanks so much for your insights today. Great answers the entire time. Again, you can read Duncan's work on Pistons Powered. You can listen to him on Locked On Pistons. And what's your Twitter handle, Duncan? Where else can we have people follow you or find you?
They can find me at DuncanSmithNBA on Twitter. It's where most of my work on Twitter ends up going. So that would be the follow right there.
Awesome. And Dan is at Dan Favalle, F-A-V-A-L-E. I'm at Andrew T. D. Bailey. There's also NBA Math and Hardwood Knox. You can follow those as well. And give us a rating or a review on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Stitcher, all that stuff helps us. And as usual, we end the podcast with Dan's favorite staple.
Hate you.
A shout out to Beno Udrih.
Former Piston Beno Udrih.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he was probably the league's best third point guard last year, which is a real high bar.